Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. Citizens appear to know very little about politics and government today. When asked simple questions on these topics, millions of people give incorrect answers. Who is your U.S. Senator? Or who holds the majority in the House of Representatives? Often, voters give no answers at all to these and other civics questions. Given this state of affairs, it's not surprising that experts often deride the public for its ignorance and low voter turnout.
We look at the statistics on turnout and we say 57%, that's pretty low. But another way to think about it is that the United States has more elections, we elect more offices than almost any other democracy in the world. So when you look at turnout in an average election, we're amongst the lowest. When you look at average number of votes cast per person, we're at the top.
Our guest expert today is Dr. Arthur Lupia. Dr. Lupia is the Hal R. Varian Collegiate Professor of Political Science at the University of Michigan. He serves on advisory boards for several science communications endeavors, including the Division of Behavioral and Social Sciences and Education at the National Academy of Science and Climate Central. He's also the chair of the American Political Science Association Task Force.
There's so much competition for people's attention. We have cat videos, Dancing with the Stars, and all that. To try and get political information in the contest, you really have to make it relevant to people's lives.
We have a lagging interest in politics, at least some of us do. But during this election season, it means a great deal to be informed. And Dr. Lupia will share with our Not Old Better audience what's going on and what he means by uninformed. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Arthur Lupia to the Not Old Better Show.
Welcome to the Not Old Better Podcast. It's time for this week's featured guest on the Not Old Better Podcast. And now your host, Paul Vogelsang.
Dr. Lupia, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Lupia has written a very important book. I think it's very timely, and the name of the book is Uninformed: Why People Seem to Know So Little About Politics and What Can We Do About It. Dr. Lupia, it seems like voter turnout is up and down over the years, and maybe that's an indication about the lack of knowing. Maybe when you don't know, you don't go. But what do we do to inform people about what's going on in the political world? And it's just, I noticed in some of the research that I'd done that 57% turned out for the 2012 election. So what's kind of going on? And what do you mean when you use this term uninformed?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And, you know, there are really two parts of it. One is about turnout. And, you know, one thing that we look at the statistics on turnout, and we say 57%, that's pretty low. But another way to think about it is that the United States has more elections. We elect more offices than almost any other democracy in the world. So when you look at turnout in an average election, we're amongst the lowest. When you look at average number of votes cast per person, we're at the top. So some of what happens is fatigue. You know, there are a lot of elections. We elect judges and dog catchers, and we have lots of referendums and so forth. Whereas in other countries that have higher turnout, sometimes they have just one election every 2 or 3 years, and it's for a single office, and that office then affects everything. So I think with turnout, you have some fatigue. And because of the number of elections, it really matters to get people interested. And so, you know, if people feel like there's something really at stake in a particular election, they'll go participate, they'll register, they'll take the time on election day to do that. But if people feel that the argument doesn't really apply to them, or it's two people saying different versions of the same thing, a lot of folks stay home. So that's the turnout story. But it's a little different than the information story, because there are some very well-informed people who choose not to vote, and there are some people who don't know very much who choose to vote. So getting people informed is a little bit of a different story in that, you know, there's so much competition for people's attention. You know, we have cat videos, Dancing with the Stars, you know, foreign news and all that. And to try and get political information in the contest, you really have to make it relevant to people's lives. So when we're telling stories about how to improve the lives of children or how to improve the quality of life in your neighborhood, people listen to that and they learn about it. But if you're talking about things that people can't relate to their life, then they tend to tune out, because cat videos can be really entertaining.
Absolutely. They are very entertaining. I pay attention to those myself. I also pay attention to polls. And I think for every single election, you know, in every municipality, in every local government, in every state government, there seems to be a poll associated with that election.
Yes.
And polls, it are often derided. Maybe that's because of their reputation a bit. But I've read that you've said that the absence of polls really is the greater peril here, and that maybe without polls, politicians and special interests, you know, can't make their claims or tell their stories. And so what is this idea of polling, and how does it impact the way in which we get information and influence turnout, maybe?
Yeah, no, thanks for asking that question. Polling is really important in a democracy because it's a way to try and figure out what the public wants or whether the public is divided and why. So polls are really powerful. And for that reason, you have some organizations like Pew and Gallup, for example, that are very careful and they run really great polls, by which I mean they sample all kinds of Americans, they don't ask leading questions, and they present the data such as it is. But because polls can be so powerful, you have a lot of what we might call pretenders, people who want to produce numbers that seem like they're real, but they're not. So a lot of your listeners probably know about robocalls, where you have some robot calling and asking you questions. Or you have somebody calling you on the phone who at the beginning they pretend they're a pollster, but at the end they want you to contribute money. So part of what's going on in polling is that there's a gold standard, and then there's a lot of people who are doing like Gucci knockoffs of polls. And so that's an issue. But I think that, you know, the bigger point that you raised before with polls, which is really important, sometimes people say, well, we'd be better off without them. And so my question is, if we didn't have polls, then how would we learn about what the public wants? This isn't an experiment. We have countries where polls are illegal or they're discouraged. And in those countries, the otherwise powerful people, they will tell long stories about what the public wants, and there's no one to compete with them. So, for example, you might look at Erdogan in Turkey right now, mm-hmm. who's, you know, making a lot of claims about, you know, what's good for democracy. There aren't pollsters in the room. So he is making his own version of what people want. The same thing happens in Russia. Pollsters are not really allowed to do the same things in Russia that they are in the U.S. And so the views of someone like Vladimir Putin about what the public wants are often offered in public without the competition of data.
How do we distinguish between some of these kind of quote unquote Gucci polls and start to trust and understand polling better? I heard the other night on CNBC, as Hillary was kind of announcing her pick of Senator Kaine as a running mate, one pollster say, it'll be interesting, I think this is the exact quote, it'll be interesting to see what comes as we pull this ticket. It was almost as though we need to know after the fact whether or not the decision was the right one, and maybe that casts some doubt on the overall, you know, meaning of the poll. And so how do we make sense of some of these polls and really give them kind of this idea of almost a grade so that we know that we can trust them?
Yeah. One thing, a lot of this is on the press because, you know, individual voters, you can go find polls. And if you go look for a poll, you know, what you really want to do is find a polling organization that will be really transparent about how it collected its data. You know, what was its response rate? In other words, if it tried to interview 4,000 Americans and only 400 answered the phone, what did we learn about that? Some polling firms will be really honest about that. They'll say, here's how we solicited people, here's who turned us down, here's why how we tried to adapt to it, and so forth. The more honest they are about their methods, the more believable they are. There are others who won't tell you anything. They'll say, we have a secret sauce, and just believe me and believe us, and that's when you need to run. I mean, I think that's something if people search for polls, but most people don't search for polls. So this is really, you know, myself and people who run sort of credible polls have been trying to work with reporters. And this is difficult, right? Because the 24-hour news cycle gives reporters an incentive to go histrionic, to go hysterical, sorry, about every new poll number that comes out and treat it like it's like the new reading from heaven. And, you know, it really misleads the public when the reporters aren't making judgments between which polls are credible and which polls aren't. So trying to work with the major media organizations to just, you know, there's a group called APOR, the American Association of Public Opinion Researchers, who has a one-page guide for citizens or reporters that can help you think the questions to ask about a poll. And basically, if you can't say yes to all of them, that is, if they won't be honest with you about how they did things, the way I treat it is just for entertainment purposes only, like the pinball machines in the arcade. You know, if you can't find out how they collected their data, it's just candy. It's just noise.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll put a link up to that one pager so that we can help our audience kind of understand this distinction. But there is more information than ever out there already. And so how is it that we can kind of get the attention and break through so that people are paying attention to the right things, getting the information they need so that they can become more informed.
Yeah. So this is an interesting question. So here's a story that I start the book with to just kind of place how to think about information. Sometimes we think there's a group of people who know everything about politics, and then there are those other people who know nothing. But the fact is, all of us share the following thing in common. So last year, you know, in a typical year, let's say the last 10 years, Congress passes about 200 laws. And my state legislature passes about 100 laws per year, and my city passes about another 100 laws per year. I'm an expert on this topic, you know, of what voters know. And if you ask me to give you the complete list of the laws by memory, I can't do it. I can only remember two or three of these laws. Moreover, in any given year, although I did read the Affordable Care Act, but that's because I'm a geek.
Wow.
Yeah, it's 912 pages. It's fascinating. Beyond the laws, most laws that are written are really vague. And so usually you have to go to the bureaucracy or to a government agency where they fill out a set of rules, and the rules specify how the law is going to be implemented. In a typical year, like last year, there were 70,000 pages of the Federal Register, which is an official record of government laws, that were just dedicated to interpreting laws. And no one has read that. So here's the point. There's two groups of Americans. One group understands that they're almost completely ignorant of so much that happens in politics. That's one group. And the other group is delusional about how much they know, right? Those are the only two groups. So there is no such thing as the fully informed person. Having said that, there's information you can use to make a really big difference. And so, you know, a lot of what I work on is how to get the information you can use. And to make the story really short, what decisions do you get to make? What decisions do I get to make? And what is at stake in those decisions? So if I'm voting for president or senator, or if I'm serving on a jury, or if I'm asked to, you know, advise on a piece of legislation, the most powerful information for me is stuff that's factually accurate, but that also relates to the kind of values of for myself or the people I'm trying to represent. If I can get information that is both helps me make a decision based on the facts and the relevant values, right, then I can do a lot for myself, for my community, and my country. If I have information that is either not factually accurate or not tied to values, it's harder to use. And your listeners might be surprised to hear me use the word values so much.
Yeah.
But in politics, you know, my background is in mathematics. And so in math, you can separate facts from values. But in politics, you can't separate them. The things that we're arguing over aren't strictly kind of, you know, science questions. They're questions about when does life begin, or, you know, how much support should we give to the poor rather to the rich, domestic interest versus international interest. And those aren't science questions. They're deep moral and ethical questions. And one of the reasons they remain part of the political process is because they're people with different values live in our country, and they're trying to sort it out. And so to get someone to listen to information, the one thing you can't do is say, okay, first of all, your values are wrong, because that shuts down the conversation. But if you can say, I understand where you're coming from. I understand, you know, your vision of your life, or your family's life, or your community. Here's how it relates to mine, and now let's find a set of facts that are relevant to us as a whole, trying to make our lives better. That's when you get people's attention, and that's when people really become interested and learn about politics.
And so I'm making this jump then, and you'll just have to correct me. So if it's tied to my set of values, if this kind of this information is tied to my set of values, I become more informed, I'm more interested, maybe I buy in a little bit more to kind of what's going on around me. Does that then translate into voter turnout?
It can. It can. I mean, if you think that no candidate for office is talking about the things that deeply affect your life, then why would you vote, right? And so that's how a lot of people who are disaffected by the political process think, no one's talking to me. And so on election day, that there are a lot of other things to do, particularly if you live in a place where the lines have gotten really long, or it's a rainy day or whatever, that people just decide, you know, there are millions of votes, mine won't matter, why won't I go? It's the people who feel this passion, who think that one side or the other really has the ability to take the next step in helping themselves or their families or their community or their nation. That's what gets people to turn out, the idea that it's a critical moment, that it's, you know, either a passion or a duty. Because when you think about it, you know, if you and I go vote in November, the chance of your vote or my vote breaking the tie is basically nil. Like, we're not going to break the tie. So the reason to go vote is not because we're going to determine the winner. The reason to go is because we want to express something. Like, we want to express a passion or a desire or a point of view. And so when people feel that about a particular candidate, that's when you see the turnout.
Fascinating. My listeners know, and I mentioned this, that you know I live here in Washington, D.C., and there are lots of stories told here. And you kind of mentioned this idea of storytelling. Who's doing a good job storytelling? Are politicians, are they using these stories effectively? Are they just talking about these big amounts of information, or are they really identifying with the electorate so that they can tie into kind of some of these values in a way that presents their case almost as aspirational?
Yeah, I mean, well, that's the key. I mean, if you can tell a story about government performance, either past, present, or future, in terms of people's own aspirations, you have an audience, right? So, you know, I'm going to be bipartisan here. President Obama has become very good at this, right? Mm-hmm. You rarely hear him talk about a policy now without his speech being wrapped around personal stories of how this policy has improved the life of this woman from Des Moines or this family from Bakersfield or something like, you know, that's a core part of his narrative. Ronald Reagan, if you're a Republican, he was fantastic at this, right? I mean, he presided over a very big government that made a lot of technical decisions. But when President Reagan went out in front of people, he told, you know, stories about, you know, individuals and compassion and sort of, you know, a human scale view of government. So for most people, what government does is so complicated and remote that if you read them all the statistics, it would be a snooze fest. I mean, they would just go to sleep. Mm-hmm. And so the candidate who can both talk about policy and make it relevant to people's lives, such that when a citizen is in the audience and they hear President Reagan or President Obama speaking, and they're like, they're talking to me, like they understand me, right? That's when you get attention. That's when you get people really focused. That's when people will follow what you say and maybe become more interested and passionate. So all the candidates today try to do this. They succeed at different levels. But I think that most of the contemporary candidates with good support staffs know that this is the sweet spot.
Yeah. And it seems as though, and again, not to get partisan, but it seems as though, you know, between some of the in the Democratic primaries, maybe Bernie Sanders was able to kind of use some of the storytelling a little bit better than Hillary was.
I think so. He seems to have a comfort with it. I mean, I think that Secretary Clinton has some skills, but this kind of human scale storytelling is not. She doesn't seem comfortable with it. Bernie Sanders seems a little more comfortable with it. President Obama became very comfortable with it. I don't think either of them are quite at his level. So, you know, I think Donald Trump, in a way, is pretty good at it. I mean, he doesn't tell kind of soothing narratives, but he will get to the point really quickly and make it personal to you.
Mm-hmm. So you write this book, and if you're a data geek, it is terrific. Again, I want to remind everybody, the title of the book is Uninformed: Why People Seem to Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. It's by Dr. Arthur Lupia, who's here joining us. And Dr. Lupia, I wonder, as we're kind of talking about the candidates a little bit, what's going through your head as you watch the RNC convention end and the DNC convention begin, as a matter of fact, today, as this is being recorded? And what are some of these catchphrases that are being used by the candidates to kind of describe each other? And how do you kind of evaluate those from almost a polling phrase? You know, you hear words like unfocused by, you know, Secretary Clinton described Trump, and words like crooked Hillary by Trump. And are those words, are they enough to trigger in our electorate some kind of knowing, some kind of information?
I wouldn't say that they're enough. I would say if you find the right words or the right example and it works, then, you know, the typical strategy is just to use it over and over again. So, you know, I'm not sure, crooked Hillary, for example, I think is sticking with a subset of Trump supporters. But for the more general population, I don't know what effect it's having. You know, I think when Donald Trump went after Jeb Bush and he said low energy, that was devastating, right? Because it was in two words, he got to a huge problem that Governor Bush was having. I mean, Governor Bush is very educated and he's very articulate on policy. But on a debate stage with Donald Trump, you know, it was just those two words encapsulated the entire problem that Governor Bush was having with Donald. So when you get a set of words that match the moment, they can solidify that moment and kind of let people remember it over and over again. But the fact is that candidates, they don't know in advance what's going to stick. A lot of the time you can test it, you can run focus groups or surveys. So they try a lot of different things. And if you find a theme that really works with an audience that you need, then it can be the basis of your campaign. During the convention weeks, you're hearing a lot of different ideas. It's too soon to tell whether the Republican campaign had words that stuck. I mean, the problem for Donald Trump is that the most memorable image from the campaign was Ted Cruz, right? Yes. After the problem with Melania Trump's speech and then the Ted Cruz moment, two of the 4 days where they were trying to create a new narrative for Donald Trump, the narrative was plagiarism on the one hand and then this battle on the other hand, you know, Cruz not endorsing him. So that was 2 out of 4 days where they lost the message. A lot of what you try to do during a convention is to reset the message for your candidate, to sort of reset the narrative in a way that is more sympathetic to you. So, I mean, I think Trump saved himself a little bit on the last day with his speech, which was rather focused. But for the Democrats, which, you know, we're at the beginning of the convention here, they're going to try and weave a new narrative about Hillary Clinton that is consistent with what people see and that puts her in a stronger position to proceed in November. Whether they'll be able to do that or not, we'll see.
After the conventions, then what happens in terms of the race? Because one-on-one, and I've heard you talk a little bit about this too, one-on-one is maybe tougher for candidates to kind of go unchecked using rhetoric. And is it easier then after the conventions for voters to make sense of all this because they've got maybe this almost just one-on-one matchup and there are fewer candidates, not 17 Republican candidates, yeah. There's just the one?
Well, one of the things to realize, I mean, you know, this primary season got a lot of attention. But if we take the total number of votes cast during the primaries, I don't have the last number, but I think it's less than half of the number of votes that were cast in the last presidential election. So, you know, primaries, typically the people who vote in primaries are the ones that are more passionate about a party, that are kind of already the party regulars. And so now the folks that we have coming online after the convention is everybody else who hasn't been paying that much attention, who are either disaffected from politics totally or who find themselves in the middle. And so a lot of what the post-convention strategy is about is talking to those voters, what we call the swing voters, and trying to, again, introduce your candidate to them in a way that's relevant to their lives. The tricky part is you can't offend your party loyalists, so you can't stray too far from the things that you said during the primary. But both Trump and Secretary Clinton are going to have incentives to try and get at, let's say, these centrist or unaffiliated voters. That's where the move is going to be. How do you speak to people who are not party loyalists, but get them to vote for you anyways?
Yeah. Is there a point that, you know, kind of despite maybe some of these disgusting words, the crooked and, you know, all of these terms, is there a point after the conventions that people just decide not to get involved because they're just so disgusted with the process?
I think the sequence works a little differently. There's some work done by students of mine about how you process information before you make a decision and how you process it afterwards. So before a decision, you're looking in the environment trying to figure out which candidate is close to your point of view, which candidate can improve your quality of life. And then at some point you pick a team. You might not tell people you've done it, but in your mind you sort of lock in and you pick, you know, the Yankees or the Red Sox, the red or the blue, something of that nature. And then what happens after that is you hear everything a little bit differently. In a sense, if someone says something that supports your team, you're more receptive to it. If you hear somebody challenging your team and why you vote for them, you become a little reticent, maybe even defensive. You don't want to hear it anymore. And so after people start to lock in, they hear information differently. Now, where the turnout thing can come in is if people haven't chosen a team and we get late into the process and the campaign's really negative, in the sense that both candidates are not spending a lot of time talking about what they would do for you. They're talking about what the other candidate will do to you. You know, at some point, people might say, I want nothing to do with this. You know, this is not a process, not a debate I want anything to do with. And they check out. So that's one way that negative campaigning late in a sequence can reduce turnout. But the other way it can do is suppose, you know, we have a candidate that we like, and we've decided we're definitely not going to vote for, we're going to vote for A and not for B. But then we keep hearing negative information about A, and it leads us to doubt our choice about A. In presidential elections, very few people who kind of lock in at one point on one candidate change their minds. And so what happens then is if you learn enough negative things about your candidate, again, you just drop out as well. So I think negative campaigns can have an impact on reducing turnout, but that happens because people haven't heard a positive argument from a candidate that resonates with them.
The name of the book is Uninformed, Why People Seem to Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It by Dr. Arthur Lupia. Dr. Lupia, I've got two sons, And they are getting various degrees of civic education in kind of our public schools here. And I wonder from the book, what are some of the other solutions that can keep us informed? And how do we, as parents and as people, try to strengthen these kids' love of country and our community and our government and give them a sense that they can be part of this system?
Again, that's a great question. And I think there's a couple elements. First of all, when we think about the teaching of history, you know, one of the things that's important about teaching history is it gives us a sense of our shared backgrounds. It gives us a sense of some of the battles that have been fought prior to our lives, the alternatives that our society considered and accepted or rejected. And that series of decisions can tell us a lot about who we are, like not as an individual, but as a collective. And that can be really useful because when you meet strangers and you're trying to figure out, do I trust this person or not? Do I hold the door open or not? Am I sympathetic to this person or am I indifferent to them? The essence of shared humanity, knowledge of the things that, you know, matter to them and matter to us, they're really powerful social lubricants. And so for that reason, you know, understanding these types of things, whether you get it through the history at school or the history at your church or whatever, it's such an important part of social life, of learning how to be kind to other people, how to trust people, how to build relationships. So that's critical. But the other thing I would say is that if we teach like history absent information that's more relevant to the decisions that people will have to make, then it can seem kind of dry and distant. So, you know, if we think about the decisions that our children will have to make, even if, you know, they can't, it's hard for them to think about the future being adults. So trying to provide information about politics and showing them how the decisions that government makes are relevant to their lives right now, what they learn in school, whether or not they can drive, you know, who they can love and things of that nature. Those types of things can make government less abstract. And those are the types of examples that if a young person realizes government isn't something that happens to me, government is something that I can be a part of, that I can influence to try and improve my life and the lives of others. When a young person has that realization, it's a powerful thing. And I think that's where some of our best civic leaders come from. So again, I'd say a mix of history and real attempts to take the abstract nature of government and show people how it affects their day-to-day lives and their most important personal decisions. That's the type of education, I think, that can create great citizens.
One final question for you, just real quickly. Let me just make a jump across the Atlantic and talk about Brexit for just a moment and ask you, is this going to mean anything to the U.S. presidential election? You know, I've heard the phrase, first Brexit, then Trump. Is it just too simple to say that? Or is this one of those cases of kind of the uninformed in that most Americans are just not paying any attention to Brexit and it's irrelevant to them, so it's not going to affect the race?
The Brexit campaign, I think, is not really comparable to the U.S. presidential election. It's more comparable to the types of referenda that they have in California or things of that nature. So I can tell you what happened with Brexit was that the people who were supporting the Remain side, they do not appear to have taken their opponents very seriously. I would even say that the leaders of the Leave campaign ran a much better campaign than did Remain. The leaders of the Leave campaign, you might question their honesty, but they were very direct in saying, look, if we leave, we'll take £450 million, put it back into the National Health Service, and you'll have better health care, right? Or, you know, we'll have fewer immigrants and fewer problems. Whether you think, you know, there was racism in there and there was xenophobia in there, but the Leave campaign was very committed and very consistent to saying, if you vote to leave, here's the personal consequence for you. The Remain campaign, I think, they believed that a referendum was an intellectual debate rather than kind of a more emotional thing. And so when people in places like Birmingham or Brighton or like, you know, factory towns were saying, you know what, my family has had jobs in this community for decades. All the factories are closed. We've lost our jobs. We've lost our way of living. These immigrants are coming in and taking over our cities, and we're frightened. You know, many of the sort of intellectual leaders of the Remain campaign just ignored them and blew them off. And like, you don't understand all the great benefits of trade liberalization, you know, and I think a lot of voters that were in a lot of pain in the UK felt that they weren't being listened to. And so, you know, one of the lessons of that campaign was that, again, an election isn't an intellectual argument. An election is really a contest of values. And in that case, people had a lot of reasons for voting no. But part of it was the sense that, you know, the elites weren't listening to them. Mm-hmm. So that type of idea has certainly transferred over to the U.S. election. But I'm not sure it leads exactly to Trump, because, I mean, the other undercurrent with Brexit is, you know, the EU is this other level of government that has the potential to usurp, take powers away from your national government. And so there's always been this concern in Europe about this new level of government. That's not really at play here. I think not everybody believes that Donald Trump is the best solution to elite leadership of a country.
It's a terrific book, and I want to recommend it to everybody. Uninformed: Why People Seem to Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. It's by Dr. Arthur Lupia, who has just an impressive list of credentials and somebody I've really enjoyed talking to, not only in terms of the great informative program, but in terms of my own family and how I can be better informed as well as my children. Thank you so much. We're out of time. And Dr. Lupia, I just want to say thanks again for joining us today. The book Uninformed is excellent. We'll put up some links to it. We'll also find that one pager that you mentioned, but I'm so delighted that we've been able to spend some time together. Thanks again, Dr. Lupia.
Well, thanks for having me. This is a great program, and I'm glad to be part of it.
Thank you very much.